Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
Well, I spent Friday morning reading to and speaking with children at the Dion Warwick Academy, an elementary school in East Orange, New Jersey. The East Orange School District is 87.6% black. And every year, my wife and I, Joni Light, take part in the Celebrity Read program of the United Way based in Newark, in which during the month of February, people who are in various professions and occupations go into the schools and spend time with children reading and talking about how important reading is to our lives and the work we do. So I had a pre-K and a third grade class that day. And I read to the third grade class a book I had found in the school library earlier that morning, or parts of it. It was titled Voice of Freedom, Fannie Lou Hamer, The Spirit of the Civil Rights Movement, a biography in verse by Carol Boston Weatherford with some wonderful collages as illustrations by Akua Holmes. And it was too long a book to read all of it. But before starting, I said to the class, do any of you know who Fannie Lou Hamer is? And hands shot up. And the little boy sitting right in front of me, like that far away, said, I learned about her in the Black History Month class. And other kids said, I did too. Well, in case you haven't noticed, February is Black History Month. And today's message is keeping with the celebration and the spirit of the month. Now, what is now Black History Month began in 1926 as Negro History Week. A week that included February 12th, Abraham Lincoln's birthday, and February 14th, Frederick Douglass's birthday. The historian Carter G. Woodson, one of its founders, and Frederick Douglass are both identified as historic African-American humanists on the website African Americans for Humanism. Now, the existence of humanism within African-American religion and culture is a rather inconvenient truth, as is the existence of Islam and Yoruba and Buddhism in African-American communities, and there are extensive instances of all of those religions as well. In fact, the leader of one of the Buddhist groups I knew in Florida was an African-American woman. The assumption that all African Americans are Christians is a strong one. However, as Rice University professor Anthony Pinn has demonstrated in several books, including The Varieties of African American Religious Experience, aspects of Islam and African religions survived long in slave culture and into post-slavery culture, that there were practices of Muslim practices and prayers and Yoruba prayers that were practiced by slaves, even under slavery. And he describes how religious humanism is also a long-existing, though minority, religious practice among African Americans. And that's what I'm concerned with today, and it's an inconvenient truth, I say, because for both African American Christianity, whose leaders for the most part believe they are the religion of the African-American community, and for Unitarian Universalists. There is a long history of humanism in African-American culture, and it goes back to before the Civil War. But there's also a long history within Unitarian Universalism of African-American religion, religious humanism. Anthony Pinn, who wrote the book The Varieties of African-American Religious Experience, is a member of a UU church in Texas. And he counts as one of his intellectual mentors, William Ronald Jones, an African-American Unitarian Universalist minister, religious humanist, and professor for many years at Florida State University, where he headed the Religious Studies Department and the African-American Studies Departments, both. In the 1970s, Jones argued that there were two African-American religious traditions, one theistic and mostly but not exclusively Christian, the other, a minority numbers to be sure, humanistic. His 1973 book, in which he lays much of this out, is titled, Is God a White Racist? And it is still powerful and relevant. And Christian theologians of liberation have spent much time and energy trying to refute his arguments, but that's a different day to have that conversation. Norm Allen Jr. is the former executive director of African Americans for Humanism, which tells you that group hasn't been around long enough to have a former executive director. And Norm Allen was there for many years. African Americans for Humanism is now affiliated with the Center for Inquiry. And in the 1990s, he edited an important anthology entitled African American Humanism. So I draw on these and other rich resources and will provide an introduction, and only an introduction to this topic, by looking at four aspects of African-American humanism. Its deep roots in African-American culture, literary expression of humanism in African-American literature, the Communist Party as a home for African-American humanists in the 1920s and 30s, and efforts to create humanist religious communities with African-American constituencies. Well, first, the deep roots. We all know the central role that the Christian church has played in African-American communities. If you've been to the post office this month, you've seen this year's African-American or Black History Month stamp, which is James Allen, the founder of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. It is important. So important that when in the 1980s and 90s, the Unitarian Universalist Association tried to build diversity, it decided that it could only increase membership among African Americans by starting liberal Christian congregations in African American communities. This is what I call the Christian assumption. Now, in his book, Is God a White Racist?, Bill Jones made the argument that most understandings of Christian theology as preached in the black churches just can't be theologies of liberation, that something else has to play that role. And that's the argument he had through his entire career with African-American theologians of liberation, who took him seriously. And Anthony Pinn has marshaled historical evidence that calls into question the assumption that African-American liberal religion must be a liberal Christianity. And he also argues that Christianity provides an inadequate way of dealing with evil in the African-American experience. He went to Harvard to become an African Methodist Episcopal minister. He left a humanist with a PhD in religious studies. In his book, The Varieties of African-American Religious Experience, he quotes an AME bishop in 1839, the Reverend Daniel Payne, who feared that the slaves would give up Christianity. This is a quote from Payne. The slaves are sensible of the oppression exercised by their masters, and they see these masters on the Lord's Day worshiping in his holy sanctuary. And they know that oppression and slavery are inconsistent with the Christian religion. Therefore, they scoff at religion itself, mock their masters, and distrust both the goodness and justice of God. Yes, I have known them even to question his existence. A few nights ago, between 10 and 11 o'clock, a runaway slave came to the house where I live for safety. I asked him if he was a Christian. No, sir, said he. White men treat us so bad in Mississippi that we can't be Christians. The basis for humanism in African-American culture, argues Pinn, is the inadequacy of Christianity to deal with the evils of slavery and racism. Both Frederick Douglass and W.E.B. Du Bois grew up within the Christian church, both became later critics of Christianity in relation to the struggle against slavery and for civil rights. In fact, Douglass first worshipped as a Christian, even preached for a while after he was freed from slavery. But then he came to be a critic of Christianity, saying the churches would be shocked, and I quote here, at the proposition of fellowshipping a sheep stealer, and at the same time they hug to their communion a man stealer, and brand me with being an infidel if I find fault with it. Now, of course, when Frederick Douglass came north and changed his name, having escaped from slavery, he did take part in a black Christian church in New Bedford, Massachusetts, but soon connected with the abolitionists, and his first speech to a mostly white gathering was at the Unitarian Church in West Roxbury, Massachusetts, whose minister at the time was Theodore Parker, the abolitionist. W.E.B. Du Bois grew up in New England Congregationalism in western Massachusetts. A black family was his in a mostly white church. And it was warm and loving, and he felt quite nurtured by it, but eventually came to criticize the black churches for focusing too much on hell and damnation and criticizing people for minor things when there were bigger struggles to be had. And such critiques are not limited to political reformers and activists. James Weldon Johnson, who is both a literary figure and the first paid employee of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, was also an author. One of his books is titled God's Trombones. It's transcriptions he took down of black preachers who preached orally and without manuscripts. And it's poetry. It really is poetry. It's a wonderful book. It really retells biblical stories with a vividness that few even white evangelical preachers can achieve. And Johnson is also the co-author with his brother of the hymn, Lift Every Voice and Sing, known as the Negro National Anthem. Johnson was a religious skeptic. He wrote, "My glance forward reaches no farther than this world. I admit that I, throughout my life, have lacked religiosity. I do not know if there is a personal God. I do not see how I can know, and I do not see how my knowing can matter. As far as I am able to peer into the inscrutable, I do not see that there is any evidence to refute those scientists and philosophers who hold that the universe is purposeless, that man, instead of being in the special care of a divine providence, is dependent upon fortuity and his own wits for survival in the midst of blind and insensate forces. All that is clearly revealed is the faith that man must continue to hope and struggle on. To do this, he needs to be able at times to touch God, let the idea of God mean to him whatever it may." James Levy, who wrote a biography of Johnson, talks about how Johnson resisted family efforts to get him into church and finally settled on what was a thoughtful and quite consistent agnosticism, putting him into a large number of other participants as he was in the Harlem Renaissance in the 1920s and 30s, where there was much literary expression of humanism by African-American artists. Zora Neale Hurston, Richard Wright, Langston Hughes, and many other writers who came out of that period were religious skeptics and humanists. Langston Hughes wrote a memoir of his childhood describing how the family had pressured him to be saved in church. And he finally allowed himself to be saved at his aunt's church when he was 12 years old, and then went home and cried himself to sleep. And this is what he wrote about that. "I couldn't bear to tell her that I had lied, that I had deceived everybody in the church, that I hadn't seen Jesus, and that now I didn't believe there was a Jesus anymore since he didn't come to help me." in a slightly young, in a younger generation, James Baldwin had the experience in Harlem. He said, "My friend was about to introduce me when the pastor looked at me and smiled and said, 'Whose little boy are you?'" Now, this, unbelievably, was precisely the phrase used by pimps and racketeers on the Avenue when they suggested, both humorously and intensely, that I hang out with them. Perhaps part of the terror they had caused me to feel came from the fact that I unquestionably wanted to be somebody's little boy. I was so frightened and at the mercy of so many conundrums that inevitably that summer someone would have taken me over. One doesn't in Harlem long remain standing on any auction block. It was my good luck, perhaps, that I found myself in the church racket rather than some other. And James Baldwin was baptized and as a teenager became a preacher. But eventually, you know, lost any faith in the in what he had been brought into as a vulnerable teenager. And wrote about this experience in The Fire Next Time. "When I faced a congregation, it began to take all the strength I had not to stammer, not to curse, not to tell them to throw away their Bibles and get off their knees and go home and organize a rent strike." And he later puts it this way: "If the concept of God has any validity or use, it can only be to make us larger, freer, and more loving. If God cannot do this, it is time to get rid of him." And then Alice Walker, younger than Baldwin again by a decade or two, has understood and rejected the Christianity of her upbringing in the rural South. In that excerpt, it talked about her mother being kept silent in the church. Her mother was like the mama of the church and led the other women around in their efforts to keep the church neat and clean, but they were never allowed to speak. And she tells that story and how she evolved, you know, from being a growing up, potentially growing up to be a church mama like her mama, to becoming a naturalistic humanist with a Buddhist practice. And in 1997, the American Humanist Association named her Humanist of the Year. And she described this journey. And you heard some excerpts from that in the readings. I just want to read one more short passage. "I seem to have spent my life rebelling against the church or other people's interpretation of what religion is. The truth is probably that I don't believe there is a God, although I would like to believe it. Certainly I don't believe there is a God beyond nature. The world is God, man is God, so is a leaf or a snake." Alice Walker. Well, also in the 20th century, particularly in the 20s and 30s, there are other humanists among the African-American community, and many of them found a home in the Communist Party. Not just in Harlem, but in the South, a place where religious dissenters could affiliate. And the historian Robin D.G. Kelly argues that many of these 1920s and 30s black humanists came to their humanism through the Christian tradition, through its calls for justice and righteousness and an ethos that fought oppression. It was based on scripture, but they didn't see the church as doing that work, and the party was doing that work. And that became a home for many African Americans. It was, ironically, in Kelly's words, "the prophetic tradition of Christianity that was a major factor in drawing blacks into the Communist Party and its mass organizations." Benjamin Mays, a historian, a black historian of Christianity, wrote in 1973 about the failures of the black church to address real issues, instead offering complacency, and how the social crisis then raised questions about the efficacy of those churches and God's reality in the world and effectiveness in bringing justice. And we have to remember that although churches were central in the civil rights movement, many of them did not take part, and Martin Luther King Jr. was driven out of the denomination in which he was raised because of his activism, and had to form a new Baptist convention with other black Baptist ministers who were activists. The churches were not all activist. Kelly quotes the experiences of a church-going African-American communist named Hosea Hudson, who challenged the deacons of the church about whether there was a God and what was going on, and people are being lynched and you ain't doing nothing about it, he said. But he also said, I never did finally stop believing in God. I haven't stopped believing yet today. I don't argue about it. I don't discuss it because it's something I can't explain. I don't know whether it's a God. I don't know whether it's not a God. But I know science. If you take sciences for it and all these developments, I can't see what God has much to do with it. So it's something beyond my knowledge to deal with. And I don't deal with it. I don't try to deal with it. So Hosea Hudson, not a highly educated person like James Weldon Johnson, also moves into a kind of agnosticism, lived as a humanism. But the Communist Party provided for many such people a path towards the kinds of transformation they weren't seeing the churches doing in the 1920s and 30s. And Hudson himself was challenged by his fellow party members as to why he was going to church and wasn't out organizing the community. And the fourth aspect of this is organized African-American humanism, and there is a lot of it. Some of it within the Unitarian tradition. You probably all know that Ethelred Brown organized the Unitarian Church in Harlem in 1920. That was built on the model of the service as a forum. This is similar to the community church movement that Universalists and Unitarians had put together at that time and were building. And it sought to connect religion and politics in a manner that was, Brown insisted, in contrast to most of the Harlem churches in this regard. Clearly, there was a large appetite. People, thronged to the congregation, but they were not all humanists, so they complained to the American Unitarian Association about the atheistic tone of a church that drew communists and socialists. But Brown, who was Jamaican, by the way, and came here as a young adult, believed that African Americans, like himself, needed to move away from the emotionalism and what he considered superstition and otherworldliness of many of the black churches of the old-time religion. So he created a church, a black humanistic church in Harlem, which he supported through menial jobs his entire life. He was an elevator and an operator at a department store. But he tended it loyally until he died, after which it faded away. And the leader of the American Unitarian Association never grasped that Brown was a well-respected clergyman in Harlem. And in spite of his humanistic and leftist orientation, invited to preach at the premier church of Harlem in that era, the Abyssinian Baptist Church, where Adam Clayton Powell Sr. was the pastor for many, many years. The white Unitarian leadership just couldn't get so far outside their stereotypes to see how effective Brown was. In 1947, Chicago, Lewis McGee, a Unitarian minister, organized a free religious fellowship on the South Side, initially poaching black members of the Chicago Ethical Society to start it. And he built up a congregation that long survived his retirement, mostly but not exclusively African-American, the humanistic in orientation, active in the NAACP, the civil rights movement, and other social justice efforts. So there have been for many years been African-American Unitarian Universalist Humanists. There is a long history, but there's also a long history outside Unitarian Universalism. I mentioned African-American members of ethical societies. But there are also specifically African-American humanist organizations. I already mentioned African-Americans for Humanism, which has branches all over the United States. Several of their branches include the Black Nonbelievers Incorporated, based in Atlanta, whose leader is a woman named President Mandisa Clack, an unusual name. She's the president. There is the Ebony Exodus Project for African-American women leaving organized black churches. There are groups like the Bronx Community College Secular Humanist Club and the Center for Inquiry in Harlem. And in keeping with what I've observed is a long characteristic of the ethical culture movement, the Brooklyn Ethical Society has among its members Haitians who have recently settled in the United States. There are African-American humanist organizations beyond even our liberal circles. So African-American humanism has a long and deep history. It is a vibrant minority voice in 21st century American religion. It has long had a home within Unitarian Universalism. And in fact, many of you probably don't know this history, when the Black Power Movement, Black Empowerment Movement, roiled this association more than 40 years ago, many of the leaders who led the formation of the Black Affairs Council were African Americans and identified as humanists. But nonetheless, people still accept the dominance of Christianity among African Americans, and yes, it is the largest group, but there are practitioners of Yoruba, of Buddhism, many Muslims, and many humanists. But yet, people seem to think that liberal religion, and this is something a lot of white liberals believe, liberal religion, including Unitarianism and religious humanism, is not attractive to people of color. Anthony Pinn tells a story of how, when he was teaching at McAllister College, he kept visiting Unitarian Universalist congregations in the Twin Cities area, and would often be told he might like the church down the street better. Well-groomed, young African-American scholar with three graduate degrees from Harvard and a professor at a local college. And he would come to General Assemblies and give talks for the religious humanists group and say how frustrating it was that he didn't feel welcome because he felt like he was one of us. Till finally, when he moved to Rice University, he went to visit a UU church in Houston, and they welcomed him right in. They didn't assume that because he was black, he might not fit. Now, this is awfully inconvenient for the stereotypes a lot of liberals hold. It's awfully inconvenient for leaders of African-American Christian churches. But I, for one, welcome the inconvenience and indeed celebrate it. For how else do we grow except by being challenged by reality? So let us dig into this inconvenience and enjoy it and learn from it and see how we can grow. And so may it be.